So as I said, when we first got together this evening, I just came back from some extended time away, and actually Tuesday I'm leaving again for a couple of weeks, mostly to go on a meditation retreat with my own Dharma teaching mentor, Joseph Holstein. So going on retreat is one of the things for those of us who teach the Dharma that makes it possible for us to continue to do so, because it's not one of the things that you can just sort of teach from memory. It only really works if each of us who shares the Dharma, whether it's in a traditional teaching capacity, or just talking to friends, or just in terms of our bearing, how we witness the Dharma and how we live our lives, that its authenticity and its life, its vibrance, comes through the experience of our own practice, right? It comes through how we live our lives on a daily basis. And so going on retreat for those who can find the time to do so in their lives is one of the ways to not only keep your practice and your understanding of the Dharma fresh and alive and close and intimate, but also to really have the transformational effect that allows you to, what I call, bear witness to the Dharma, to actually teach the Dharma through your very being without even having to speak necessarily. So at any rate, I just came off this retreat with some fellow Dharma teachers, and on the last day we had where we were having our retreat at the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies, as a place where visiting scholars and monks and whatnot who are teaching in the United States from time to time kind of come and hang their hats. It's kind of like a refuge for those who are temporarily in the United States to teach or do scholarship. And one of these people is Bhikkhu Anālayo, and he is he's of German ethnic lineage. He's been a Theravada monk for, I think, about 20 years or so now. He's in his early 40s. He got his PhD from a Buddhist university in Sri Lanka. He wrote his dissertation on the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, the Greater Discourse on the Establishing of Mindfulness, which also became then his first book, Satipatthana, the Direct Path to Realization. He's since written several others that personally I have found to be very inspiring, as has been my experience in sitting with him. So when we were together on this retreat, every year this group plans what it wants to focus on for the next year in terms of the themes we want to study and the teachers we want to bring in. And we decided that the following year we wanted to focus on Dharma teaching and the climate crisis. And in preparation for that, since I had just sat with Bhante and Anālayo recently, I knew that this was very much on his mind. We invited him to come and give some teachings on that subject at the end of our time together in our retreat, which he did. And so a good deal of what I'm going to be sharing this evening actually is drawn from the talk that he gave and the question and answer and discussion period that we had after he was finished. And it occurred to me that much of what we covered, although we were talking specifically about Dharma teaching and the climate crisis, was actually equally applicable to the broader subject of mindfulness and social action generally. And so, since I know that we have a recently formed group within the Sangha that is interested in these matters, I wanted to have that be, you know, the theme of my talk tonight, and also any discussion that might ensue from that as we sit together. Um, So in doing so, I want to make sure that everyone remembers that the teachings that I'm offering on this subject tonight are mine. There are many, many other Dharma teachers from different traditions that have taken up the same subject and have sometimes come to some different conclusions. And these are, of course, my own views, like everything else, are also subject to change. So, I think one of the hallmarks of a good Dharma talk, certainly in my experience as a yogi, but also in having done some teaching, is that when something really resonates, although we may be hearing it for the first time, it also feels like we're being reminded of something that we already knew. Right? And so one of the kind of starting points, I think, for these reflections on Dharma study and practice and its relationship to social action is that there is a very direct and inescapable relationship between the depth and the maturity and the authenticity and the vitality of your own Dharma practice and your own Dharma understanding and your ability to translate those things into mindful social action. The two are inseparable. They go together. You can't really have one without the other. Otherwise, you quickly lose the ability and you lose your effectiveness insofar as trying to manifest the Buddha's teachings in social action in a compassionate and a non-dual perspective. This doesn't mean that you should feel inhibited from engaging in any form of social justice work if your motives are not totally pure and your words and actions are not beyond reproach, right? As I've said several times in this group, a few years ago, it seemed important at the same time that I was on sabbatical from my teaching at the University of Colorado to also go on sabbatical, 6-month break from Dharma teaching, just so I could take a step back and reflect on the work that I'd done up until that time and really check in with my intention going forward, in terms of whether there were any things that I might want to do sort of differently in the future. And after a few weeks of intensive sitting practice at the Forest Refuge in Western Massachusetts, I had my exit interview with my teaching mentor and friend, Joseph Goldstein, and said, well, you know, I've come to the decision that going forward, I don't want to teach the Dharma anymore unless I can do it from a position of not-self, you know, from emptiness and having no attachment to my teaching. He says, oh, I see. You don't want to do any more Dharma teaching until you reach the fourth stage of enlightenment. He said, if everybody had that opinion, the Dharma would not have made it to where it is today. You know? We all teach from wherever we are. You know, we do the best we can given our current stage of understanding and the maturity of our practice and our ability to convey to the best of our knowledge the essence of what the Buddha had to offer. So just be mindful, you know, just pay attention to your motives and your intentions going forward, you know, and do what you can to keep them as clean and impeccable as possible. And when possible, as we say sometimes, you know, to the extent you find it possible to get out of the way of the Dharma, do so. And so it is with us. If we somehow have the expectation that we can't engage in any form of social action, from the Buddha Dharma perspective, if we can't do it with the purest of motives, and being completely free from a dualistic perspective or from the arising of grief or despair or anger, then not much is going to happen, you know, really. So, really important to not set an unnecessarily or impossibly high bar. You know, we all just do the best we can. But at the same time, what I'm trying to convey here this evening, you know, if you wish to become engaged in some form of social action, whether it's in the realm of addressing the climate crisis and environmental degradation, or gross socioeconomic inequality, or bigotry, or violence, there are many ways to go about doing this. And you may have already discovered some that work for you or that you find to be meaningful and effective. All I'm trying to do this evening is to offer some guidelines for if you decide that you wish to engage in this kind of social action and this kind of advocacy from the standpoint of, from the perspective of the Buddha Dharma and the teachings that the Buddha had on the subject. And he did indeed have teachings on the Dharma and social action. Then there are certain guidelines that he put forth and that Bhikkhu Anālayo reiterated during our talk that I want to share. Like I said, there are many ways to engage in social action. There are many discourses out there. There are many organizations that are involved. However, to the extent that your thoughts and your words and your deeds are motivated principally by anger towards and disparagement of the other, on attachment to your own views and your own desired outcomes, and that the wrong views of all others will be dispelled when they recognize the rightness of yours, whatever you do will not be in accord with the teachings of the Buddha. So, what does it mean to bear witness to the Buddha Dharma and the realm of social action? Bearing witness in this context means self-consciously bringing your own Buddhist understanding and practice to bear on whatever form of social action you decide to engage in, whether with other Buddha Dharma yogis, other faith communities, or secular organizations. If you decide you wish to do this, there are in fact several practice steps that you can follow. And they're based on the Eightfold Path, the Dharma Chakra. Step one, if you want to follow this path, you know, mindfulness and social action. Step one is to look in the mirror. Before you engage in social action, check in with yourself. That is, practice mindfulness. Carefully inquire into the nature of your mind at that point in time. And the simile that the Buddha used in this regard in particular was one, if you were looking into a bowl of water, like a kind of a flat bowl with a very, you know, clear bottom. Okay. If the water is still and the water is clear and pure, when you look into it, you can see a clear and a pure and a well-focused image of yourself. You can see your own mind being bright, malleable, wieldy, inclined towards imperturbability, as the Buddha said. In other words, a mind imbued with equanimity. Then you're good to go. On the other hand, for many of us, when we look into the bowl of water, that's not necessarily what we see. If you're looking into the quality or the nature of your own mind during this check-in process, the Buddha, his simile of a mind affected by anger or resentment or a sense of injustice, as if the water, the bowl of water had been put over a flame and had begun to boil. You know, you can't see a clear image of what's going on in your own mind because the water is boiling and it's disturbed with the heat of anger or passion. Doesn't mean you're not being a good yogi. In fact, it's just the opposite. What you're doing is applying the power of mindfulness to the recognition that the mind is angry, that you're feeling resentment, that you're feeling the pain of injustice, that you're feeling disturbed at how others are doing things to the earth we share that are endangering us all. So it's just to recognize that that's what's going on in the mind, nothing more. If the mind is really brightly colored, if the water is brightly colored, and there's some hue, red or violet or blue or green or whatever, what that connotes, as the Buddha taught, is attachment to outcome. Okay. Craving, wanting things to be a certain way that they're not. Wanting things to be the way that you want them to be. So if you're going in to do this work from the perspective of there's a particular way I think things ought to be and they're not, okay, and I'm going to keep working until they are the way I think they ought to be, that's craving. It's a source of suffering. And it's going to impair your ability to be effective. If the mind is anxious and fearful, the Buddha said that's as if there was like some kind of breeze blowing over the top of it and the water is disturbed. And so there may be fear bordering almost on despair. You know, in a sense that all is lost, you know, that any action is coming out of a place of maybe feeling a little frantic or as if this is our last chance, you know, and we're doing anything in a frantic effort to stave off the collapse of the biosphere. Simply again to understand that that's the state of mind. Really being able to tune in to whatever the state of mind happens to be is a really critical prerequisite to being able to act skillfully and effectively. So once having checked in with yourself through the practice of mindfulness, then you can discern where the mind is at. If you realize that the mind is troubled in any of these ways, then the Buddha offered a variety of skillful means by which you can engage in self-care or if you're with a group of others, caring for each other in ways that address the state of mind that you find yourself in. So, if you're feeling a lot of anger or resentment, that hurts. You know, the Buddha said, you know, that being in being angry and in conflict with another and seeking to harm them, you know, is like throwing hot coals at them. He said, you may or may not hit your target, but you will surely burn your fingers. It's painful. It hurts. Right? It's painful to you. It can be painful to the other in terms of any speech or action that you might take. So, the Buddha's response to that, look at that harm, the pain that you're causing to yourself through the anger and the frustration and the resentment. Okay. Offer yourself compassion for that. And then reflect on any times that you may have felt anger or resentment toward yourself for not having measured up to your own ideals of how you should be. And how that felt, how that hurt, right? And how useless it ultimately was. And then based on that experience, based on the having come to know the importance of compassion for yourself, of being kind to yourself, when you see the mind doing that kind of thing, what you can then begin to realize is that those who are acting in ways that are really unskillful, that are really dangerous to the future well-being of all life on the planet, including us, it becomes possible to start to feel some compassion for them because of your realization that they are living in hell. That their minds are imbued with the three poisons, the three torments of the mind. Their minds are imbued with greed. Their minds are imbued with hatred. Their minds are imbued with delusion. And those are the driving forces of their words and their deeds. Sometimes it actually feels like the governing principles of, you know, our country, of society, you know, are in fact the three palaces, you know, attachment, aversion, and delusion, right? And to some extent, that seems to actually be manifesting, right, of course. So, and it's almost impossible sometimes not to feel aversion to that fact. You know, what the Buddha says is that it's really important to understand that feeling aversion to how those national political leaders and corporate leaders are behaving, feeling aversion to them is basically just an outward manifestation of the aversion that we sometimes feel toward ourselves when we're manifesting the same states of mind. This is heavy lifting, and this really isn't so easy. You know, for those of us that may have been working long and hard, maybe for most of our practice life, as an old maybe moi, to come to the place where we can make peace with ourselves and feel genuinely compassionate about all the things we maybe don't necessarily like about ourselves. Okay? We have to turn that same work toward our regard for those who we think are doing horribly, dangerously unskillful things to our planet and to each other and to us as well. That there is real power in the ability to bring compassionate regard to that kind of behavior. In the same way that we have come to, you know, entertain and host a healing relationship with ourselves through a compassionate regard for what we regard as our own shortcomings, that to the extent that we can develop a compassionate heart toward, for instance, the entire system of carbon-based energy into which we were involuntarily born and to which we were subject and which we realize needs to come to an end and it needs to come to an end soon. How to go about doing that without demonizing, disparaging, denigrating the other? How to go about doing that without self-shaming, without saying, oh my God, you know, I drove here in my car, you know, I cook with natural gas and whatnot. We do that because we don't have any choice, you know. We're doing everything we can to move away from those systems, but in the meantime, this is where we are. So developing some sense of compassion and self-regard first for ourselves and our suffering, developing it for those who we consider to be doing the greatest harm. Really important step. When we're feeling anxiety and worry, almost always those feelings, they tend to reside up here, at least we think they do, but that emotional state likewise really suffuses the body. And so when we're feeling that anxiety or that tension or that fear, okay, really important thing to do is to just drop the consciousness down into the body and say, what's going on here? How does this feel? One of the things that tends to happen when the body is in a state of fear, this is true for most mammals, is that all of the muscle sets become tense, as if they are going to be like primed for action, right? And when that happens, the musculature tenses up, the breathing becomes rapid and shallow. And when the breathing becomes rapid and shallow, there's less oxygen that's flowing around in the body, which, guess what, tends to make the mind fearful. And so it becomes this phenomenon, this repeating phenomenon. And so you can start out feeling anxious, and the tenser and more contracted you feel, you can actually start gravitating more toward a state of semi-panic. And so one of the things that's really helpful, which the Buddha taught as the first foundation of mindfulness, attend to breathing in the body. So whenever you feel those states of mind arise, you read some terrible piece of news or something about, you know, how we're all getting ready to go up in flames. How's it feel in the body? What's going on here? Okay. And, you know, it's like every once in a while I have to just tell myself, step away from the computer. Get up, walk away, and check in with the body, okay? Just, what's going on? You'll almost always, what you'll discover is that all the muscle sets are tense, right? And the breathing is shallow and rapid. And so, what do you do? Well, breathe consciously. Okay? Take a moment, close the eyes, check in. Do the same thing that we do when we start to sit every Sunday night together, whenever you start to sit. So kind of do that just kind of gentle sweeping, you know. Consciously allow each of the muscle sets in the body to relax and settle in. Pay attention to the breathing. Really relax the thoracic cavity. Take a few deep, slow breaths. Let them go, come in fully. Hold, relax, let it go, do it again. Just for a minute or two, right? break that cycle. Step out of that fearful mind state, that anxious mind state, because you've gotten back in touch with this living thing. It's only here in the moment, right? That this body lives in the moment. This body doesn't live in the past and it doesn't live in the future. It lives in the moment. It's only our thoughts that live in the past and the future. So just coming back into the moment. Okay. So there's that. And so now, for the most part, we've been talking about the meditative factors, right? Being mindful of the emotional states that are coming up in the mind. Okay. Being mindful of your thoughts as well. The vast majority of us get most of our information about what's going on with regard to climate crisis, gross social inequality, violence, bigotry, and oppression from a really, really shallow layer of information. Mostly what comes through social media or the internet or the headlines or whatever. So one of the things that the Buddha taught insofar as the practice of mindfulness, he said, if you really want to inquire into the nature of your own mind, then with calm and balanced regard, have a really close look at what's going on in the mind. See what the truth of your experience is. When we're looking at issues of social action we may want to get engaged in, that same advice applies. It's really worth careful, mindful inquiry into whatever the topic is that we're concerned about. Okay. Looking for the most authoritative sources of information that you can find, ones that you trust, and doing what you can to make sure that your concerns, and what Anālaya talked about a lot, and what the Buddha talked about too for that matter, is this relationship or the distinction between concern and fear. Okay. Between concern and anxiety. Okay. So much of the coverage of the climate crisis and environmental degradation, for instance, is fear-based. It's using fear as an effort to try to motivate action. But there's a lot of social psychology out there that indicates that fear doesn't work. It's not a motivator, it's a paralyzer. And it quickly leads to despair and inertia. So, insofar as a careful, clear inquiry into the nature of whatever it is that we're concerned about, really important to distinguish between concern and fear, and then to educate ourselves with regard to the matters that concern us. So when, for instance, you know, I'm planning on giving a number of talks down the road about mindfulness and social action on various topics that are of concern to people in this group, when we next get together in August, I'm going to be talking about mindfulness and the environmental crisis. And the research and the reading that I've been doing, and I've been trying to follow the advice that I just gave, you know, is going to the most authoritative sources that I can for information that I trust. And this is also an area that I used to teach in. So where I find myself placing my trust more than any other single source right now, there's a couple of them actually, but the main one is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is a United Nations research undertaking. The top scientists from nations from around the world all focused together on both trying to model the what's going on in the climate, but also modeling different potential pathways, different potential approaches that humanity might take to working through the crisis. And there are actually an infinite variety of paths out there. They're all kind of like these cones of probability when they're trying to track where a hurricane might go, right? But just for simplicity's sake, they've identified four major different ones that I'll talk about in more detail later on. Only one of those out of the four basically is one that describes dire consequences. Okay. The other three, to varying degrees, say, yes, really rough stuff is going to happen, and as a result, their predictions are that there will, in fact, be effective responses that happen. The worse things get, the more likely that we are to do something effective about it. Okay. So there's only one of those paths that basically looks really grim in both the relatively short-term and long-term future, and that is one that's based upon doing nothing about trying to control greenhouse gas emissions and continuing to expand on the use of carbon-based fuels. Unfortunately, right now, that's what we're doing. So the early predictions of the worst case scenario are actually the path that we're following right now. And so it's based upon that we get all the headlines about how, you know, the place is about ready to fall apart and we're all going to die in 30 years or whatever. When in fact, the bulk of the predictive thought actually heads in a different direction. So unfortunately, in an effort to try to get people to wake up and do things differently, there's been a lot of emphasis placed only on the worst case scenario and extrapolating out from that. And for me, it's really been useful to look at the entire array of predictive paths that are out there and all the factors that may go into them being chosen instead. I've done actually also a fair amount of research in disaster management. It's one of the things that I taught when I was at the university. And I actually co-authored a book called Cassandra's Curse. Cassandra was she was one of the daughters of King Priam of Troy, and she was favored by the god Apollo, and so he was trying to get up with her, and so as a way to try to get her to respond to his overtures, he gave her the gift of being able to see the future. But she kind of flipped him off. She didn't care for him. So he couldn't take his gift back, but what he did do was put a curse on her so that anything that she said about what might happen in the future wouldn't be believed, and she would be considered to be a mad woman. And so she correctly predicted that the people that were besieging Troy were going to give a gift to the city that they shouldn't accept, you know, because inside of it was basically SEAL Team 6, you know, Agamemnon and his crowd, and they were going to come in there and destroy the city, which they did. Our book, Cassandra's Curse, is about those of us who predict really bad things happening. No one listens to us, right? And so in studying disaster management and disaster prediction and disaster response, we have multiple case studies that show that there is never any kind of really meaningful long-term disaster preparedness that ever happens until there have been a series of catastrophic disasters. And so chances are that's what we're going to have to undergo, you know, increasingly serious catastrophic natural disasters, flooding and wildfires and all the rest of it, until so many people suffer that it becomes undeniable that something that's going to have to happen. But the modelers are saying, yeah, that's probably how it's going to have to work. And once it becomes evident that that's what's going on, chances are there are going to be some pretty revolutionary changes that are, in fact, going to have the effect of keeping us from destroying ourselves and life on Earth. So all I'm trying to get across here, and this is, you know, this is only result of my own research and study, and there are many sources people can turn to. All I'm trying to say is that it's really helpful to try to find out for yourself what the most authoritative information and knowledge is that's out there. Because for the most part, it's not based on fear. It's not based on trying to compel action based on creating a sense of panic. Okay? For the most part, it's really knowledgeable people who are trying to educate us all to our situation and what we can do about it if we choose to do so. The Buddha said, you know, in the opening verses of the Dhammapada, we become what we think. All we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we create the world. If we think that we are powerless and that we can do nothing to change how things are, then we are. If, on the other hand, we think that both our individual actions, and especially those in consort with other like-minded people, can in fact make a difference, can in fact change the course of human history, they will. In the teaching of the Buddha, it all starts in here. Right? What do we think is possible? What do we think our own capabilities are as practitioners? What do we think might be the ability of us in combination with others to bring about the change that we think is so desperately needed? Ultimately, what the Buddha taught is that if we believe we can do it, we can. And unfortunately, I've gobbled up all of our time. We've got to go home now. But I promise when we get back together again next time, there'll be more space for discussion. Thank you for being here tonight. For listening.